At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Change is the big word of the day, with a resounding midterm vote sending new blood into Congress and state houses across the country. But how much change Americans are in the market for and in what direction still feel like open questions today. Real change is not easy. It's often ducked. It's seldom achieved without strong leadership. America flourished when its strengths and direction aligned with the realities of the 20th century. Will it adapt and flourish again amid the challenges of the 21st? On the day after a big election, there's the big picture question. Up next, On Point, political philosopher Michael Sandel and business world leadership guru Warren Bennis on change and America. Joining me today in the studio is Michael Sandel, one of the moment's most important political and public philosophers, says the Washington Post's columnist E.J. Dionne. He's professor of government at Harvard University, author most recently of a collection of essays titled Public Philosophy and of the earlier Democracy's Discontent, America in Search of a Public Philosophy. Michael Sandel, wonderful to have you here with us on this day. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And with us from Culver City, California is Warren Bennis. Forbes magazine calls him the nation's dean of leadership gurus. He's a groundbreaking thinker on organizations and change in the business world. He's founding chairman of the Leadership Institute at the University of Southern California, where he's a university professor. He's author of An Invented Life, Reflections on Leadership and Change, and has consulted many Fortune 500 companies and to presidents all the way back to Reagan, Johnson, and Kennedy. Warren Bennis, thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here, Tom.
So here we are on an extraordinary day in America's political life. You both think a lot about the fundamentals of change in communities and how they pick up and embrace change or do not. Warren Bennis, first to you in California, when you look out on this country on this day and think of the challenges it's facing in the 21st century, the vote that's just come down from the voters, do you see a country truly ready for change, or is this just a political slogan of a political season?
Tom, I think the country is ready for change, but it's not very clear where and what direction it's going to go in. Machiavelli, a long time ago, said, change has no constituency. I think that's a very apt phrase for today, because it seems to me that there are a lot of, we don't like this, we don't like that, and maybe the slimmest constituency that maybe turned the edge in many of the close elections was the Iraq War. And that's something that many people are against, primarily because of the lack of competence and results that we see every day on television. So I think we're at a point that physiologists often refer to as labile. I think things are like Brownian motion still. Things are very, very much in flux. And I don't think there's any, at this point, any core constituency that we can say as it was, let's say, in 1932 with FDR or the Cold War. I don't think yet it's crystallized. It's become solid yet. I do think the against things are now more important. People's sense of subjective well-being is in play, and I think the phrase "in play" is a very apt one right now.
Michael Sandel, exit polls find an awful lot of Americans not confident that the next generation will live as well, have the quality of life that they've had. That sounds like maybe the beginnings of a constituency for change. On the other hand, maybe not. It could be reaction. Do you feel a constituency for change beyond the kind of political headlines of the moment for real change?
I think, Tom, there is a readiness for change, but I think what the election we just had shows, well, I think it shows two things. First, democracy works. It worked last night in a very simple, straightforward way. There was a disastrous war. People wanted a change in the course of that war. and they voted the incumbent party out. So it worked in that sense. But democracy is a very blunt instrument. People talk about sending a message through the ballot box. The messages that come through elections are not terribly articulate and precise. So what remains, given this willingness, even insistence on change, what remains is for the political parties and for political leadership to reimagine the political landscape. And we don't know now, the electorate doesn't know now, exactly what the shape of that change will be. If we look back at 1932, which Warren just reminded us of, it's true there was a fateful change then with the election of FDR. But then, as now, it was essentially throwing out a party then that presided over a disastrous depression and an economy. The full shape of the New Deal, the reimagining of the role of the national government in the affairs of the country, that didn't, the shape of that change and the political landscape it created didn't become clear, really, until after the first term of FDR. And I think the same may be true today.
Warren Bennis, when you cite 1932 and the Great Depression as producing a constituency for change and suggest that it's not there today, are you saying that big populations, big countries like the U.S. have to be beaten further down at war, or you name it, before they're ready for thoroughgoing change, the kind of change that this century might require?
I like Michael's phrase, reimagine or freshly imagine. I think this is really the work of both parties. Let's hope it doesn't take another war or crisis like that to form the solid coalition. But I think what I sense in both parties, actually, is this lack of imagination. And, you know, I want to recall a marvelous phrase that Lord Bryce made sometime in the early part of last century. He said, perhaps no form of government needs great leaders so much as democracy. Now, I believe there's been a failure of both nerve and imagination on the part of both parties. And this is the time when I think we're going to need it. This is a time when I think we're looking for fresh ideas. And this is, I think, partly explains, for example, the kind of explosion on the scene of Barack Obama, just as an example. And it brings back to mind another time in our country, which is not the same as now. And I think it's always difficult to make these analogies between the past, but I think when you think back to JFK, Kennedy, in 1960, I was living in Boston then, and as a matter of fact, teaching at BU at the time, and I didn't know where your offices were then. But there was a sense that he was not experienced enough. But there was such a need, in light of the past few years with Nixon, Eisenhower, of some fresh, new, imaginative person coming on the scene whose potential was still unknown. So I do think that what both parties have to face is to take a look at this very complex stew of issues that Michael mentioned earlier, including such things as immigration and war with Iraq and the Middle Eastern turmoil. And I think there's been a cortege of disappointments that have taken place. Perhaps Katrina is an example of the starting point. Perhaps it was before that. Have we done with 9/11? But I think there's a need on the part of the American people for a platform which they can get behind. And thus far, I don't see either party as having that.
We'll look at how that might happen. But I want to get each of you sort of on the record so we understand your view of things. You talked there, Warren Bennis, about the need for change. Michael Sandel, first to you. Do you see a raging need for change here? Do you see a national crisis without it? And what kind of challenges, in your view, if you see a need for change, what are the challenges that raise it?
I do see a need for change, and the fundamental change, I think, has to be to the political agenda itself, which frames the questions for democratic debate and for voting. Think back now. The current political agenda essentially was commandeered by September 11th and then by the war in Iraq. But it's an interesting exercise to think our way back to September 10th of 2001. Before the war in Iraq and before the attack loomed and dominated American politics, what was the shape of the political agenda? What were the main questions? George Bush had just won a very narrow split decision with Al Gore. And essentially, in their debates, they were debating various plans for prescription drugs for seniors and
humble foreign policy.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And there was no broad, ambitious agenda then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think by the next presidential election, there will be more or less an agreement about disengaging from Iraq, put aside the details. And so the question will then be, what is American politics about now and in the future? There are a few big issues that loom. Healthcare is one, and energy policy is a second, and the persisting debate over taxes, rich and poor, is a third. But I don't think those issues, which beyond Iraq are the main mm-hmm. issues on the horizon, are enough to constitute a new political agenda. I think that the political figure who finds his or her way to reimagining the shape of things will have to find some way of framing the question, who are we as a people? What are the sources of commonality in an increasingly pluralistic society? And what about the fate of the nation at a time of globalization when the boundaries of the nation become more and more porous? This has to do with the debates about immigration and also about free trade. But more than that, what does the porousness of national boundaries in our time due to markets and the movement of peoples have? What are the implications for how we conceive our collective identity and some sense of the common good? That's the big question.
You're talking about change and definitions at the most fundamental level. Let's go to Don in Townsend, Massachusetts. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Yes, I simply wanted to make a comment in terms of just being hopeful about the election. And I mentioned to someone yesterday that we want to be able to make that decision to change and be hopeful about it. And I don't feel like there's a lot of that going on right now. And I actually question whether or not fundamentally as a culture we're willing to make the sacrifices that those changes would entail.
Let us pick it up, Don. Thanks very much. Michael Sandel.
I think Don makes a very good point, and he mentioned a key word, which is sacrifice, the willingness to make sacrifices for the sake of the kinds of changes that we need to confront. We were speaking about trying to have a politics that's oriented to the common good, and one very concrete expression of that that brings it down to earth and connects it with actual issues mm-hmm. is this idea that Don mentioned of sacrifice. Now, we've been fighting a war in Iraq, and it's gone very badly, and we know all about that, and people have rejected that. But one of the features, one of the most troubling features of that war is that the American public as a whole has not been asked to sacrifice. To the contrary, we've been cutting taxes while we've been fighting a war, and Americans have been sacrificing their lives, those in the military. And after September 11th, you remember, the American public was willing, more than willing, yearning to sacrifice for the sake mm-hmm. of the common enterprise of responding. And yet there has been no call to sacrifice. When we look at the litany of issues, energy is one of them, energy independence. But to achieve energy independence requires more than just various technological fixes. It also requires, I think, a willingness to summon Americans to sacrifice, to make changes in the way we live and drive in order to contribute to the common good of weaning ourselves from our dependence on oil. And so here's an example where this very broad question of the common good mm-hmm. is connected by the idea of sacrifice, which is a very important but missing theme in our politics, to a very concrete policy issue. So I think Don actually raises a very important suggestion.
Warren Bennis, do you feel the makings of national change in the air here? I mean, it's been, Republicans might say, look, all the way back to 1994, we were banging the drum for change. The Republican Revolution was certainly a big change in the tenor in Washington. It came along with a kind of yearning for values, maybe some yearning for the past, but also there was embedded in that among its advocates, the idea that we needed a sort of values revolution to go forward effectively into a new century. Do you feel fundamentally in Americans these days sufficiently deep sense of need and urgency around changing to adapt to what's clearly a changing world?
Mm. Very much so. I've no doubt about that. The feeling in the air, the essence of it all is change and needing change. The form it's going to take isn't very clear yet, seems to me. Now, there have been many issues, especially the Iraq War, the energy problem, which Michael mentioned, and other things. But I do think there's not a clearly defined framework, paradigm, point of view, which will take sacrifice. And also another word Don used in his question was hope. Both of those things have been absent. But I think we've got to figure out not just what the content of the platform is. I think most people would agree on some of the issues we've already discussed here. But it's clear to me, Tom, that it's in the air. It's the feeling. But it's also a frustrating feeling because, as I said, and I want to underline this, the form that will actually shape people to get behind something has to be much clearer than it is now. Right now, it's what we lack, what we don't have. Sacrifice, hope, and toughness. But I just want to say one more thing.
Yes.
I don't think this can be possible without our leadership doing something about bringing us to the change. And I think that we can talk about world issues. It seems to me, that, to put it this way, there are at least four big issues facing the globe. And one is, for example, the possibility of WMDs somewhere, but some nuclear device, some craziness going. The second thing is some kind of plague, as we now see taking place in Africa. The third thing is tribalism. And the fourth issue is the leadership of our institutions. Without the last mentioned, none of these platform issues are going to take place. And I'll add one more thing. And just, I do think what we need in our leadership right now are individuals who can sort of point to the fact that our fates are correlated, that we're aligned behind a common set of goals. There's a movie director here in Hollywood named Bob Zemeckis, who's very popular with making movies like Forrest Gump and Back to the Future. Mm-hmm. And I asked him why he was so pleased with the audience response and his own response to the movie he did long ago called Forrest Gump. And he said something very simple. I'm not even sure he got the full import of it. He said, "We all are making the same movie. We all were making this, meaning the assistant directors, the gaffers, the best boys, everybody was involved in creating something where we knew again, to repeat my phrase, our fates are correlated. We also need a reservoir of goodwill. We need trust in our leadership. Now, those things are not true in this country now. So to talk about even a particular point of view on change, I don't think can come about until we have a few things in place. Trust in our leaders, the feeling that we're more or less a community, which we're not feeling now, and a reservoir of goodwill. And I can argue that those are the things, without those things, I've seen too many CEOs fail, and I've seen our political leadership fail. And I just want to emphasize that none of the platform will work unless people feel they're making the same movie. And the common good, which is the phrase Michael used.
I want to turn to Michael on that on the same movie theme. Let me just get you on the record as well, Warren Bennis. I've read you saying that in your view, the country is now in maybe one of the most perilous times it's ever gone through. Are the stakes as big as that?
I think the stakes are as big as that. We're playing for mortal stakes.
Michael Sandel?
Tom, could I pick up on the theme of anxiety that has come up? You've mentioned it, and Warren has. I think when we talk about change in politics, very often it begins with a sense of unease or anxiety in the electorate, often inchoate, free-floating, inarticulate, not fully formed. And it has to do with the sense that the world has changed and that the political system hasn't caught up, hasn't found a way of making sense of the changes in the world. I think that's the first challenge of leadership. Real leaders tell us stories, convincing, resonant stories about how the world has changed and how our place in it, therefore, needs to adapt. And here in the circumstance we're facing now, I think there are two ways in which this is happening. One of them has to do with something, Tom, you mentioned before when you talked about Americans not being hopeful that their children will lead lives as good as theirs. The American dream is the dream of the next generation advancing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet when demographers and economists have tried to measure mobility one generation to the next, they've found actually that the American class system, if you will, or the ranking, the economic rankings, have hardened to the point where intergenerational mobility, the chance of our children rising, is greater, actually, in Canada, in Denmark, even in France, old Europe, than in the United States.
So the rich now likely to stay rich, and the not rich less likely to rise, or the poor less likely to rise.
And the middle class terribly anxious about their children either slipping or failing to advance. I think those anxieties inform people's everyday lives, and people sense that this hardening of the system, of the structure, the sorting structure, has something to do with globalization and the way markets and technology work today. But we don't yet have a compelling story to link our individual predicament and anxieties with a convincing story, a picture, a narrative about the way the world is.
So the American dream, in a way, premised on a kind of fluidity,
right.
And yet fluidity and change also very scary. And I want to look at those. Let me take a call from Omaha, Nebraska. Randy's on the line. Hi, Randy. You're on the air.
I have an opinion that we need more of a balance in government, and with the obvious shift in power in Congress going to the Democrats, leading the way to possibly a shift in power or a shift in the executive branch in 2 years. And having an all Democratic set, basis of government, doesn't that leave us open again to the possibility of corruption, just like we have with the Republican side, swinging all one direction, left or right?
Just swinging from one barrel of trouble to another.
Exactly, because I mean, anytime I view government kind of like a child, and if you give the child the key to the cookie jar, you know. They're unchecked. They're just going to go after it.
And yet just swinging in circles here isn't going to do us a lot of good. Michael Sandel, let me ask you on this front. Warren Bennis was saying earlier, Forrest Gump was a great movie because everybody on that set was making the same movie. Now, we've had a lot of complaint about polarization and ideology. Randy in Omaha says, maybe we're moving to the center here. Is that the answer? Does the center produce pragmatism, produces changes? Is that the mathematic formula here? Or is there, in fact, a need for vision, even ideology, that works to lead out of this? Or do I hear both you and Warren saying that?
Well, I'm a bit of a contrarian on bipartisanship and moderation, Tom. I mean, who's against it? Everyone's for it. Everyone's celebrating this election for having been a triumph of moderation.
But it's also seen as a refutation of extremism that was been pretty alive and well very recently and still in no small number of quarters.
Well, that's true. But I think that, remember, even to speak of what's moderate or what's centrist and what's extreme presupposes that we know what the spectrum is about, what it measures. And a lot of what we've been discussing here is really calling into question the design of that spectrum, that political agenda itself, in relation to which people say, I'm in the middle, or I'm at this end, or that end.
The spectrum is people, isn't it? It's not just a concept.
Well, we normally talk about the ideological spectrum, mm-hmm. centrist, left, right, various extremes, mainstream. I don't think I think in times of change like ours, in times when the shape of the political agenda is up for grabs, I'm not sure that those categories of left, right, center, moderate, extreme tell us very much. I don't think the electorate was voting for a move along an existing ideological spectrum as much as it was saying, the war in Iraq has been a disaster. We also don't like the corruption. One party's been in. We're going to toss them out, at least in part.
And we're worried about the future.
Yes, and the answer to that worry, I think, has not been given by this election, will not be devised, I don't think, over the next 2 years. I think that's the broader challenge we've been talking about, really to redefine the political agenda. Ultimately, I think politics can't just be about competence or avoiding corruption or seeking moderation or avoiding extremism. It has to be about broader public purposes, governing themes, persuasive narratives that link individual destinies to the collective destiny. And that's what makes a genuine politics of change.
So, Warren Bennis, you looked at how a lot of companies work their way through moments like that. So how do you, if this was a vote for moderation, if it was a vote for balance, if that's what it was, or maybe it's a vote for change, are those in conflict or not? And Does balance, are balance and pragmatism the bywords when a society needs big change, or is it about vision, which may mean ideology? Are those in conflict?
I think it means both. I think to just take the metaphor of the story that Michael talked about, or I think we need a new movie. I think it needs a new narrator. And I think what happens when a country or a company is faced with difficulties and angst and all the issues we're now facing all at once, it's an incredibly complicated world picture and view out there. And I think it's going to take a number of things. It's going to take, yes, a new story, which is another way of putting vision. I don't think balance is the issue, because even if we look at the change in the House, you know, it doesn't look to me like it's that much of a majority, actually, and it doesn't look to me like the people being elected on both sides of the issue are anything but for the most part, they're moderate. So I don't see any Randy's concern in Omaha. I don't feel at all. I'm not concerned about the barrel tipping this way or the other. But I do think that story has to be inclusive enough. It has to be, if you look at the way corporations which have taken a new grip on life, usually it's accompanied by somebody who has, it may be from the outside, but somebody who has the trust, somebody who has enough goodwill, because going back to Machiavelli, change has no constituency. It's never easy. And in this case, we've used the word inchoate, unformed, ill-defined. I think that's where we are right now. This is a period, this election in some way may have one very good aspect to it, which is I think it will put anxiety at the head of the table that we've got to figure out what our destiny is and getting some agreement. I like the phrase collective destiny. Let me put it differently. A colleague of mine uses the word a collective definition of success. Just think of that for a moment. And what most leaders can do, are able to do, I mean effective exemplary leaders, whether it's at the political level or at the company level, I think is to create among their constituents, their organizations, some collective definition of success. And we don't have that right now.
Let me take a call from East Lansing, Michigan. Pat is on the line. Hi, Pat. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Well, what do you think, Pat?
Well, I guess I have a little idea to throw out that we all know our economic system is based on competition, on leaving the competition behind. It's what's driven our success in the world and our all of our economic growth. But how can we as a nation and even as a world come to what you call a collective definition of success when fighting each other is the basis of our culture?
When we're all in there competing?
Yeah.
Let us put that to our business world guest, Warren Bennis. Warren, it's supposed to be all about creative destruction. As Pat says, that has produced an enormous amount of wealth and change. Is that dynamic still working?
Well, I hope you don't mind if I use perhaps a very parochial example here. I heard on a TV program last week the coach of Notre Dame, who works out of brutality and fear. And
I mean, that's how he motivates his football players,
and soul, to exactly. So it's fear and intimidation and even brutality that motivates a team. I am a professor at USC, and I'm very proud of our coach, Pete Carroll, who knows that competition is extremely important, but not at the sacrifice of demonizing the enemy and treating players like they are people you can manipulate and twist around and brutalize. And, you know, I would just use those as two examples. Yes, competition, but competition for what? What are you competing for? What is the purpose of winning? Because I think when that team, when USC's team goes out to play, I don't think it's only the competition. I think it's doing the best they can. And if you talk to the great leaders, the musical conductors, the coaches, the teachers, the leaders, I think at base, you can get away, perhaps, you know, Mr. Weiss, Coach Weiss at Notre Dame, can get away with kicking college players around. But let me tell you, he's never going to make it in the pros.
Michael said,
and this is a basic difference in how we perceive human nature and the qualities, because it isn't just winning. It's winning with purpose and desire and for the common good.
But there's the question of whether, even when Americans vote for change, are they really up for it? I mean, because scary times can also produce a kind of defensive posture. You know, what do you think about that, Warren?
I'd like to respond to that quickly before Michael comes in. I think of this, the beauty of the democratic system is its adaptive capacity. You know, I cannot think of another form of government, and I'd really like Michael to weigh in on this, that has that adaptive capacity. And as a matter of fact, I may be wrong about this, and Michael can easily correct me, but I recall an article in the Atlantic Monthly some years ago, and there was a phrase he used. It wasn't his, but he was quoting, I think, from some theological canon. As I recall, it was openness to the unbidden.
Right.
Openness to the unbidden. I think it was in Michael's article, but I'm not totally sure. You're right. I think that's our capacity. It's actually the DNA of democracy, which I think, even with all, you know, the feelings of despondency we may have about the world, I hope there's a general conviction that we have the stuff to know when we ought to change course.
Michael Sandel, let me just relate to you a story. A young nephew of mine, among many, happened to be a supporter of George Bush, and I just asked him, "Well, you know, what's your thinking? Why?" And he said, "You know, I like my life. I don't want it to change."
Hmm.
So, in the face of challenges, he was looking not for change, but for the opposite, in a way.
Right, and there is this tendency in politics all the time. The more fateful the change abroad in the world, the more comforting it is to hew to what seem to be old certainties and sources of security.
So do our politics, our economy, our national character still leave themselves open to this openness to the unbidden?
I think that preserving that feature of political life is very difficult at a time when change seems threatening and when we can't quite name the threat. That's when the hunger for security seems to be the most acute, which is why it's so important for political leaders, especially those now who will be trying to position themselves to run for president, not only come with a list of policy positions, but somehow try to articulate an account of the world now and the way in which and our place within it. It's worth thinking back to how this actually works in practice. The decade of the greatest change in my lifetime, Tom, maybe Warren goes back a bit further than I do, and he can add to this. But in my lifetime, it's been the 1960s. Now, I was young in those days, but in the 1960s, if you look at recent decades, there was the Civil Rights Revolution. Mm. There was the Women's Rights Revolution. There was the protests against the war in Vietnam, and there was the transformation of American culture from what it had been in the 1950s. No decade in recent memory has witnessed such thoroughgoing change as the 1960s.
And we spent decades kind of fighting about those changes once they'd been made. Are we at a point again for that kind of decade of thoroughgoing change then? Or
I think we are. But the cautionary note when we think about politics and electoral moments of the 1960s is what really the marker, the political marker that began the 1960s was the election of John F. Kennedy, who presented himself as an alternative to the drift and complacence of the Eisenhower years in the 1950s, who had no real disagreements on issues to speak of with Richard Nixon in the 1960 debates, except, which is odd in retrospect to remember, Kennedy said he would be more vigorous in carrying forth the Cold War because we were slipping behind the Russians,
Sputnik,
remember?
And the rest.
And then he gave an inaugural address, an eloquent inaugural address that had entirely to do with America standing firm in the Cold War. And though he was a symbol of change, John F. Kennedy, the actual changes that transformed American society from civil rights to women's rights to transformations of the culture, none of that was spelled out or predicted or articulated in the campaign of 1960 or even in that eloquent inaugural address.
So it was in his body language or it was just in the Times? It was in the electorate?
I think it was largely in the Times. He instinctively recognized this yearning, this impatience, this hunger for change. He hadn't quite put his finger on it. He spoke largely within the language of the Cold War, which he inherited. So change creeps up on the political system. Democracy is, for the most part, retrospective, reacting against and intimating, but only intimating, changes that are ripe to unfold. And so now the challenge is for political leaders to try to pursue and tease out those intimations of change to address the anxieties, including the kind that your nephew described, about changes in the world. How will they impinge on us? How will they affect our life prospect and those of our children?
Warren Bennis, do you look back, or where would you point back for models of the kind of scale and of change that we're talking about now? And here we've got this whole range, all the way from atmospheric change to very specific policy changes. Michael Sandel says an effective leader will tease out these threads that help the country move forward. What threads? Which?
Well, it's really a very hard question for me to respond to that quickly, because I think before we can, but let me just go back to something that Michael said.
Yeah.
My experience of change was not easily remembered, because being born in 1925, my dad losing his job when I was seven, and actually for the next few years loaded illegal booze onto mafia trucks and ran summonses for lawyers.
And he wasn't the only one.
He wasn't the only one. I know it was in everybody, in fact, was affected. And then in the Army, just 3 weeks before I was 18, and served for 4 years and thought I was going to stay on. Certainly World War II and the Depression were key formative aspects of my worldview and how I see the world. I do, though, agree that, I mean, in terms of the theme of your program, Tom, about change and how it's going to, how and what is going, are we? I think we are at this stage in our country, despite, was it your nephew?
Yes.
Who wants to keep things the way they are? I think we're hungry spirits, all of us in this country, or most of us, I should say, right now. And I like the phrases that Mike used about teasing out the intimations, the challenges, change creeps up. I do think the next couple of years are going to be very, very exciting and important, because I think the actual shape, contours, and content of these kinds of changes regarding at least three big issues. I mentioned some before, but I would say having to do with money, family, and religion. These issues have got to be sorted out. But in order for these issues to be sorted out, in order for this country to come up with a narrative that we're all making the same movie, I think we need to feel more safety and more trust. Safety and belonging in a nation which is very divided still, despite the Democratic claiming of the House, getting of the House. I do think, I just want to say another word about the angst, the anxiety that I feel that we're all experiencing right now. I've been thinking for a long time of writing a little essay called Cells, Strollers, and Dogs. Because in my neighborhood now, we see a lot of cell phones, and we see a lot of young children, we see a lot of strollers. And there are a lot of statistics which would indicate that since at least 9/11, people are feeling sort of a cloud, an unspeakable sort of a cloud over our heads. And it's, I think, a great deal of feelings of uncertainty and lack of safety and lack of trust in our governing bodies.
But when you say safety, it makes me think of the terrorism challenge and 9/11. Well, and has the terrorism challenge been a kind of bone in the throat of change? Is it a retardant to change, the specific fear that comes from that challenge to safety?
No, I think all important change starts with some anxiety about the present. And it was very clear that 9/11 was, for most Americans and most people around the world, as a tragic surprise. We were not really prepared for this. So I do think that this is why I'm very hopeful about the, as hopeful of, in general, I tend to be optimistic, sometimes gets frayed, but I do think that anxiety is the first step toward the kind of changes to create more of a community, to create a common good that will bring about a safer, a more secure, and a more open American. I think that sense of feeling you belong, you're part of the same community, is it takes a while to create. And I like the words creeping toward teasing out the intimations. But I don't think it's going to be an overnight thing. I think the next 2 years will actually create the platform for both parties to reconsider our role in the world and what is our story. We heard the 60s story, all the changes taking place then. I think we're at that point, but we haven't had the clear, it isn't like the civil rights, it isn't like women's rights, it isn't like the anti-Vietnam War, which was so deep in our society. Mm. But I do think we're entering a stage like that right now.
What is our story? Let's take a couple of quick calls here. Pan's calling from Florence, Massachusetts. Hi, Pan, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for the very complex analysis that you're doing. It's wonderful and very important. And my comment is sort of a basic kind, which is I just want to assure you that my voting and the voting of everyone I know did not come from any kind of unformed anxiety. It was extremely informed and vehement anxiety, and we knew exactly what we were voting for, and I could give you a list.
Right, so you could punch right down the policy issues. Do you feel out of that, Pan, confidence that you're going to see those changes and the broader kind of adaptive change to new century coming? Are you feeling confident this morning, today?
Well, I'm dancing in the street this morning, but I also think that the Democrats really have to deliver, and they can't just sit around and not do what needs to be done. But I am looking forward to a government that isn't afraid to think and isn't afraid to make a commitment to educating kids and all sorts of things like that. I mean, I don't need new ideas. I need some of the old ideas that don't get any play.
So, Pan, you know what you want, and you think you know where to get it, and maybe you will. Thanks for your call. Let me get one more from Independence, Iowa. George is on the line. Hi, George, you're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to follow up on your leadership conversation and what the previous caller just mentioned. I think that the polarization that we see in the House and the Senate is really derivative of a lack of leadership. I think there isn't strong leadership. We get this polarization, and I'm not sure if they really have the kind of leadership needed to break through that polarization and get things done. I'm certainly happy that they have a shot, but I'm not sure if I see a strong leader emerging.
George, you're breaking up a little bit, but I think I've got that. Michael Sandel, George doesn't know if the new party in the majority, at least in the House, has the leadership to break the polarization. What about generally? Do you see it out there?
Well, I think it's a fair question, and I don't think we can expect too much in the way of significant change over the next 2 years. What will matter, I think, and be eventful will be the shaping of the themes that will take us to the 2008 presidential election. And it's really presidential elections in American politics are the occasions for the articulation of broad governing themes. And in our case, I think the future, the immediate future, will belong to that candidate or that party that can address two things. One, how can America exercise its will in the world at a time when our power seems frustrated in very important ways? Mm-hmm. Whatever happens in Iraq, no one is really going to think that America's will has prevailed in the world. Mm. And that's going to be an important fact of politics to contend with. And the second issue is, how can individuals and families feel that they are more or less the masters of their destiny rather than the victims of changes that are swirling about them in the economy? And so the challenge is to connect the sense of the collective destiny and the ability to control it and exercise America's responsibilities in the world with some sense of shaping our individual destinies and futures.
Well, our time is too short, but the century will be long. Let's hope we're well placed for it. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. Michael Sandel, professor of government at Harvard, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Warren Bennis at the University of Southern California, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Michael.
Special thanks today to Peter Lapson, who's been a teacher to all of us here at On Point during the last few months. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.